You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. Joining me on the line is Jeffrey A. Hirsch. Jeff is the editor-in-chief of the Stock Traders Almanac and appears frequently on CNBC, CNN, Bloomberg, Fox Business, and many other national and international media outlets to discuss market cycles, seasonality, trading patterns, predictions, and historical trends. Jeff has just written a terrific book, Super Boom, Why the Dow Will Hit 38,820 and How You Can Profit From It. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here, Dave.
Jeff, before we get into the book, please tell our listeners who Yale Hirsch is, his significance to you being in this industry, and what is the Stock Traders Almanac?
Well, Yale would be my father, and his significance to me, other than giving me the family business, was enabling me to learn at his feet, both growing up as a child and also for, you know, about 20 years as I learned the business and, you know, practically all of the most of the patterns, cycles, trends, and, you know, analytical techniques from him. For the rest of the world, and myself included, he was the person who created the Stock Traders Almanac and brought it to everyone's desktop and enabled everyone to have the sort of rhythm of the markets, the seasonal patterns, historical trends at their fingertips.
Did he make some kind of a prescient call?
He's made several. The one that is the focus of my book, or what the Superboom book builds on, is a call that he made in 1976, where after analyzing some of the longer secular trends of the market and the economy, he saw that following the major wars of the 20th century, that being World War I and World War II, and the long sort of flat sideways market movement that we had during the 30s and 40s, and then before that in the first part of the 20th century, after the war was over and the troops came home and there was peace, the inflation that had been generated by the war spending and other crisis spending leveled off, the market took off about 500%. The Roaring Twenties, and you also had that move in the 50s and 60s where the Dow vaulted over 500%. So using that analysis, after Vietnam had ended in 75, I guess the last Marines were airlifted out of Saigon, and we had that nasty bear market that brought us down to 570 in the Dow in December 74, he calculated that a 500% move from that point using similar time frames would put us at Dow 3420 by 1990.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the S&P moved up 500% from 74 to 90. The Dow took a couple more years to get to 3420, about 1992. But basically, one of the greatest forecasts for the market ever made.
Okay. And in fact, it wasn't really set in stone that you were going to get into this business, right?
Well, you know, a lot of children try to do something different than their parents, and I found it sort of hard to stay away. I'm cut from a little bit of the same cloth as Dad is. I understood sort of implicitly and naturally his line of thinking. And then as this forecast and the things that he was writing about started happening and coming true, and I was excited by the prescience, you know, the accuracy, I got involved and came in at a point where I was able to convert a lot of the stuff we did by hand. I mean, I used to run some of the numbers for even like the daily calculations using an adding machine. And, you know, early 90s, we had MS-DOS Excel, which we started putting things into. That made stuff a lot easier. Now we have programmers that do it. It was interesting to be able to use his knowledge, now mine, of the history of the market to apply it going forward. I mean, we do it on a, you know, regular basis now. I mean, we're not 100% right, but it helped us get out of the way of the big bear market in 08. We were kind of early calling the recession and the bear market in March 08, and that kept us in cash and on the sidelines for the bulk of that downdraft.
I'm sure your clients, customers appreciate that. What exactly is the Stock Traders Almanac, Jeff, and how widely utilized is it by market participants?
The Stock Traders Almanac is calendar organization of all the different market seasonal tendencies laid out in the order of the calendar so that you can be prepared for what the market is generally or likely to do. It's gotten a lot of use. I mean, practically everyone I talk to has one or has had one. Money managers, brokers, regular investors, they've had them for 44 years. I know some people that have a complete set. I am one of the lucky few that does have a complete set, though we did have to procure the first few from the 60s from different places to make sure I had that. But it was an epiphany that Yale had back in the 60s when he was working at Indicator Digest, and he just realized that he saw all of these seasonal patterns and wanted to have them at his fingertips so that he could be prepared for what the market was likely to do at any given time of year, day, month, and that's what his brilliance was back then, to put this all in a place where everyone could use it. It was basically his workbook that he put together for everybody, and that's why it stays spiral bound, so that you can flip it open. We've had people tell us to put back in more room for making notes. In this computer age, everything's typed in, but still, you find you want to write some things down, and that's what the almanac's there for. You have your May almanac on one page, and next to it you have a week where you can jot down some notes, you know, buy this ETF or this stock, or watch out for the end of QE2, or whatever it is that you're thinking, you can jot down right in there.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the website is stocktradersalmanac.com. How old is your dad now?
My father will be, or he's what, 87 now? Yeah, 1923. And still emailing me, still involved, still working on things. He still edits, and he edited the new book for me, or at least, you know, gave it a read and made his suggestions. It's dedicated to him, so I made sure that I represented him
right.
Properly. Didn't want to make any faux pas there. He's great. He's still quite active.
Excellent. Can you define the term superboom? Now, I know you touched upon that a little bit in the explanation now, but what exactly does superboom, what is that alluding to?
It's alluding to a period of time where the market goes up rather consistently, rather strongly, and consistently makes new highs over a long period of time. You could refer to it as a secular bull market. We call it a superboom because there's all sorts of smaller booms and busts. You could consider the move from March 2009 until now a boom, but we're talking about a superboom, which means a 500% move in the stock market.
Okay.
Move from Dow 6470 to 38820.
The term secular that you're using, that just means long, extended, right?
It means long term, usually at least a decade, as opposed to a bull or bear market that lasts 6 months or a year, a couple of years, something that goes over many years.
Okay. Now on page 11, you say that without doubt, the single most important non-cyclical influence impacting the stock market is war.
Right.
Non-cyclical, what do you mean by that?
It's not something that happens every year. It happens all the time. I mean, you have war is not necessarily a regular recurring thing where, you know, you have the driving season or you have earnings season or summer market doldrums. I mean, this is something that doesn't happen all the time. And it is something that, while it's going on, pretty much holds the market at bay. Puts in a floor and a ceiling. If you look back at the periods of time when we were in these major military involvements where we had a lot of combat troops overseas, you'll see the market going nowhere. And that's where we sort of make that claim that the war has that sort of power. You know, you have the presidential cycle, which goes on a cyclical basis. Every 4 years, we elect a president, whereas the wars come in and out at a less regular interval.
Which is probably a good thing.
Yes.
Yeah, or definitely a good thing. But it's interesting, the correlation, the clear correlation that you're pointing out here in the book between war and superbooms. And it's not just war. You say in the foreword, post-war peace dividends, excess inflation from war and crisis spending, and rapid adoption of new technologies are the factors that drove the prior secular market boom. So you could actually look for these components throughout history. And it works, doesn't it?
It does. It's almost like war is not what causes the boom. It's the end of war that causes the boom. It's the peacetime. It's the reinflating of the market after all of the spending that it took to fight the war and stem off the tide of other crises like the financial crisis we just had. So it's more the peace plus the inflation plus the enabling technology that creates the boom, whereas the war is the big factor in the bust that keeps the market down, that creates that launching pad for the boom.
Mm-hmm. On page 6, you have a little formula there. War plus peacetime plus inflation equals 500%. And it works, though. That's the amazing thing.
It has worked. You know, a lot of people made some bold forecasts before me, and this is one that's based upon previous success. It's not some new normal. It's not some new valuation metric. It is what's happened before. It makes sense. There's a reason for it. And I contend that it's setting up to happen again.
Right. And of course, you predict Dow 38,820. Now, you say in the book that it's going to begin in 2017. Is that right?
Thereabouts. That's my calculation based upon the secular bear moves in the past, the longer sideways moves, that it's taken that much time for the excesses to be worked off and for things to get in line with political maneuvering, with government policies being more in line with what the private sector wants. It takes some time, a few administrations, to work that out. And also, this time around, we have sort of a date for the end of the war. We have a exit date of 2014, I believe, is when the Obama administration has put the combat troops out of Afghanistan. So after the war ends, it takes a few years for inflation to level off. We haven't had inflation for a while, but I keep hearing more and more discussion of the fact that it's just popping up everywhere. And we've been saying that was going to happen. I mean, we put this forecast up initially over a year ago, and then it made it into the almanac. And then we fleshed it out into the full book. So we've been contending that inflation is brewing and is coming, and now we're seeing it. If you listen to any of the financial news, radio, TV, otherwise, or internet, you'll hear a lot of discussion about inflation. So once it kicks in, once it begins to sort of take off, and it will keep the market at bay as it sort of keeps a hold on earnings and growth and that sort of thing. And then after we get out of our military involvement, the inflation that has perked up for the previous bunch of years begins to taper off. Conditions are more favorable for the boom to begin.
Mm-hmm. And I want to spend a little more time on inflation because that was, I think, an entire chapter. I think that was chapter 9 of the book.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about the Dow Jones Industrial Average first. A lot of people don't really know much about financial indices, and when you talk to them about the Dow, of course, that's the most recognizable index to most people. Mm-hmm. They have no idea how many stocks are in the Dow, and I sometimes, you know, want them to guess, hey, how many stocks are in the Dow? You know, and they'll start at maybe 500 or 1,000.
Well, the better question is, how many stocks are there in the S&P 500?
Right. So when they find out the actual number of the stocks in the Dow, they're very taken aback by this.
By how small it is.
How small it is. Why don't you tell our listeners how many stocks are in the Dow Jones Industrial Average?
Last I checked, it was 30.
30. So the index that, as you say on page 80,
yes,
when it was created in, actually on your birthday, in 1896, you say it's the world's first consistent, trackable index that could objectively measure the fluctuations of prosperity and prospects for growth. Of course, it even had less than 30 back in 1896, right?
Yeah, it was initially the mix. There's 12 railroad stocks, and then it was initially 20 industrials when they first launched it right there in 1896.
Mm. Should we be paying attention to an index of only 30 stocks?
Yes, there's a simple reason for it. You could have an index of one stock. I mean, people have used benchmark stocks like IBM for years as a proxy for the entire market. You can look at different types of indices. You can look at broad composite indices. And these 30 stocks aren't just any 30 stocks. They're 30 of the most influential stocks in the world. So what you're getting when you look at these 30 stocks is a real microcosm of the financial universe of the global economy. One of the old technicians who I really model some things after, whose stuff I use, is George Lindsay, who's famous for the three peaks in a domed house pattern, which I've been talking a little bit about recently. In his work, he reminded you that a lot of analysts, a lot of strategists will take an index of even just 10 or 12 stocks that they feel are most significant, most influential, most representational of the broad market. So you get a really clear picture from a nice, proper, small sampling of stocks and of the market. And if it wasn't working, it wouldn't be around so long. Other indices are quite useful also, but the Dow seems to be ubiquitous. Everyone seems to get it and know when you throw out a number, everyone knows what that is. And it continues to lead. It has led over many, many years, many decades, and it continues to be a leading indicator.
Mm-hmm. In fact, on page 27, you have the Dow as one of the four horsemen of the economy, the Dow, the Consumer Confidence Index, inflation, and unemployment. Some pretty amazing things about the Dow. You know, you think about the Dow, and I guess in a contemporary sense, people think the Dow is always going to go up, even though there are these times when it goes down. But on page 88, in 1929, the Dow was at 381 and change. And you say that that level was not seen again until November 1954, over 25 years later. That's amazing.
That was an incredible time for global history. I mean, there was a lot going on that kept the market at bay. War was one of them. We had some serious climate issues. The whole Dust Bowl Bound for Glory stuff was caused by some pretty irresponsible farming issues and some droughts. And there was a few monetary policy missteps, which I think Mr. Bernanke is trying his damnedest not to repeat. And then we got into a really nasty war. World War II was something that involved everybody. So starting with the crash, crash and the depression and getting right into World War II was a period of time where the market was just not able to go anywhere because of exogenous factors and the geopolitical spectrum.
Mm-hmm. On page 98, in January of 1973, the Dow was at 1,051, and that level wasn't surpassed for about 10 years in November of 1982. On page 95, for 18 years between 1964 and 1982, the Dow was in a sideways pattern. The reason I point these out is because it is an amazing pattern. It is an amazing statistic. It's an amazing event when you think about nowadays how things happen in our world, the way that the Dow moves and the way that the markets move, the way everything moves. Would we, in this time and age, would we ever put up with 18 years of sideways movements?
We've already put up for 10 or 12 of them.
Tell our listeners about that.
We've been going pretty much sideways since January 2000. The Dow's hit a new high. NASDAQ hasn't. The Russell's at a new high here, but we're basically within the area of Dow 10,000. And if you look at the chart on page 12, which I've been told is one of the greatest charts anyone has ever seen, it looks much better in color on the internet.
Ah.
And this is kind of the crux of the whole book, where you can see I've shaded the sideways flat markets of these 15 to 20 year periods, and you can see the latest period, we're sort of doing that again. Yeah, 07, we popped up above. Here we are looking down Dow 13,000, but I don't think we've seen the last of Dow 10,000, and I think that inflation that we're starting to see pick up and the continuing difficulties with the labor and housing markets. See, we've had some good quarters here. We've had some good corporate numbers. We've had some decent economic numbers. So GDP is sort of settling down a little bit. I'm seeing the other side of that flat period that we've seen in the past continue to go on for the next several years where, you know, we'll be bouncing around Dow 10,000 between now and 2017 or 18.
Yes, I see the chart on page 12. 500+% moves follow inflation. But as you say, it does look better on the internet, right?
Without giving away too much, if you go to StockTradersAlmanac.com,
okay,
and you go to Investor Alerts, and you go to 2010, and you scroll down to May, the little scroll wheel that we all love.
Yes.
And under 13 May 2010, you see Proving Ground's next super boom. You click on that, you scroll down, and there's a bigger chart in the middle. And if you click on that chart again, it will explode to as big as your screen can be. Now, granted, I've updated the chart since then because we've had a little time elapse. It's not a whole lot different because we're looking at the better part of 100 years.
Now, this information that we just talked about, this is something that non-subscribers can get?
Well, that's an archived alert from over a year ago. So, yeah, I think the 90 days are embargoed for paying subscribers.
Okay, gotcha.
All the archives are available.
Okay, yeah, that is a great chart. You're right. Now, of course, there are a lot of factors that can influence and will influence this prediction about the Dow hitting 38,820. And incidentally, I think from what I read in the book, that's about an annualized 8.5% return, right? It's not something huge, right?
No. If you take it, I think that was done from December 31st, 2010. I mean, if you go back to the end of 1999, I think it's like a 4.5% or 5% annual return. So it depends on where you pick your starting point. But yeah, from the end of 2010, it's about 8.5%, which is well within the realm of average annual stock market gains for the long past.
Mm-hmm. And you recorded those, I think, at the end of the book. On page 126, the CAGR of the Dow.
CAGR.
What does that stand for?
Compounded annual growth rate.
Compounded annual growth rate of the Dow, and you showed between 1900 and 1999, 5% and some other date ranges there. Now, the super boom components that you list on page 83. Number one, period of peace following large-scale global military combat. Two, dramatic inflation. And three, an array of enabling technologies. I just had a quick question on the first one, period of peace following large-scale global military conflict. Can the Iraq-Afghanistan actions be considered large-scale global military conflict?
I think so. I do. We've had U.S. troops in the hundreds of thousands overseas for many years fighting combat operations.
But, I mean, the whole globe really isn't involved in it. That's why I was...
No, but if you add in the global war on terror with Pakistan and working with us and a lot of the other countries battling the different fronts, I think Europe's been involved. Now we're doing other things with NATO. It's not a world war. Neither was Vietnam, right?
Right.
So it's not exactly the same as one of the world wars, but I think it definitely mirrors the type of involvement we had in Vietnam, if not less. I mean, we were arguably in Vietnam since 1950.
Right. But I guess it's a moot point because the way that the U.S. government is behaving by producing a lot of money, we're going to get the inflation anyway, right?
Yeah. There's one of those charts, I think, back in that last chapter there, too, or the second last chapter, where I showed the government outlays versus inflation versus the CPI. And you see the big spike up. This is back in until 2010. So you see the big spike up there when we went into the crisis mode and coming out of the Iraq-Afghanistan thing. So the inflation hasn't quite caught up with that spike in outlays as it has in the previous. You can see the same spike in the mid-70s after Vietnam and the oil embargo. And then you can see the CPI pop up. Geez, over, 12.5% there.
Mm-hmm.
Inflation. I don't think we're going to get that kind of inflation. I don't think we're going to have a stagflation 70s period. That was, I don't know, about once in a lifetime, but maybe. Maybe once in a century, that kind of inflation.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, you showed on page 126 that inflation really doesn't last that long. After World War I, 1 year. After World War II, 1.5 years. But after Vietnam, about 20 years.
That's right.
Yeah. The enabling technologies. You're, of course, for your prediction, alluding to something that is going to happen, not something that had happened, right?
Right. And it could happen. I throw a few ideas out there, but I also try to be humble and not claim that I know where the next technological breakthrough is going to come from and contend that it may even be developed right now in somebody's backyard, garage, or lab, or some. There's got to be some sort of Bell Labs type thing around
right. That
we don't really know about that's working on something new. I think that it could come from energy technology. I have a quote on the beginning of chapter 10 from Thomas Edison.
I like that quote. That was great.
Yeah, that's one of Yale's favorites, too. The date's not on there, but it was right around the turn of the last century, or early in the last century. He's talking
Incredible. About
harnessing the power of the sun.
Incredible.
I mean, guy's got more patents than any single person in the world, as far as I know, but
right. He's
no mental midget. That would be something, I think, and we're starting to see that happen. I'm not sure that it's going to come from there, but something in the energy technology area where we actually really enable people to fuel themselves in a renewable fashion could also come from biotech. If we can cure a lot of people of something major like a cancer, diabetes, or AIDS, or something along those lines, or crack the human genome, that could be the kind of thing that fuels the next boom. But as I said, I don't claim to know where that's coming from. I'm only making a few speculations.
Right, of course. And of course, this was based on the enabling technologies that just recently occurred with the internet, of course.
And don't forget the microprocessor.
I was going to say that on page 102, you say that the enabling technology for the last superboom, which was the biggest superboom ever from 1982 to 2000, was programmable computer language, packet switching, and integrated circuit microprocessors.
I think the processors were probably the initial link to the whole thing, because without the processors, you don't have any of that other stuff.
Amazing stuff. Now, back in the turn of the last century, when you were talking about that Edison quote about using solar power, what were those enabling technologies about?
I think the key thing that fueled the roaring 20s was the automobile. It was in 1908 where Ford created the assembly line, but it wasn't until after World War I and everybody came home that people started really buying cars. And I don't know if anyone saw the Broadway Empire thing on HBO with Steve Buscemi.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the wheelings and dealings back then, which was in the 20s, was them trying to get roads to Atlantic City. And that was the whole thing that created those boom towns. There was new industries around the car, the gas stations, the drive-ins. So not only did it enable people to move around by themselves and get places and do things, it also created a whole host of other cottage industries around it.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole new way of manufacturing.
So that was the most significant factor, the automobile being mass-produced.
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. I think probably one of the most significant chapters of the book is chapter 9, chapter on inflation.
Right.
The three components.
Or the lack thereof.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's what I want to talk about. But these three super boom components. Number one, the period of peace following large-scale global military combat. Two, dramatic inflation. And three, an array of enabling technologies. I think that most listeners could wrap their minds around number one and number three, the war and the enabling technologies.
Mm-hmm.
But inflation is something I think that most people...
A little bit esoteric.
Yeah. Why don't you explain to our listeners what exactly inflation is?
Well, inflation is just that things get more expensive. It's the fact that the dollar loses its purchasing power, that the dollar you have in your pocket used to buy 1 gallon of milk, now it buys a half a gallon of milk. That's inflation. It costs more. It costs you $2 to buy a gallon of milk instead of one.
Does it have to exist, inflation?
I'm not sure if philosophically it has to, but it definitely does. And there's no denying that it exists. I think life would kind of go nowhere if things didn't increase in value, and that's pretty much what inflation is. Could you imagine selling your house for the same thing you bought it each and every time? I mean, yeah, you have downdrafts in the market, but I couldn't imagine things not increasing in value, and that's what inflation is. It does have to exist.
On page 98, you talk about how Nixon halted the convertibility of gold, making the dollar a fiat currency. Did that have any impact on inflation?
I believe it did. It kind of sat right there in the middle of that big inflationary move of the 70s. Without having it tied to something that you had to deliver on, namely gold, it allowed the value of the dollar to deteriorate and inflation to sort of run out of control.
So do you think going back on the gold standard would reduce inflation?
I think on paper it would. I don't foresee that happening. It's just too hard to manage currencies these days if they're actually backed by gold or other hard assets. I think the value of your currency is the world's vote on what the value of your credit is as a country.
Now, on page 112 in Chapter 9 on inflation, you say that the Consumer Price Index, CPI, the most widely followed and cited measure of inflation, is a somewhat dubious and suspect measuring tool and does not give the most accurate reading. And you went through the revisions to the CPI over the decades. And, of course, there are several components that are in the CPI. And you say on page 115 that housing has always been the most weighted and controversial factor.
Quite a few more than several.
Why don't you give our listeners an idea about exactly what the CPI is? It started, I think I read in your book, in 1921. What it's supposed to do and what the revisions have done to the CPI and why this gauge of inflation probably is not something that is going to benefit Americans now and in the future.
It doesn't give us as good of a reading as it used to of real inflation or the inflation that all of us feel when we go to the store or when we pay our bills. What it was created to do was to figure out a sort of level of increase for government salaries, the cost of living adjustment, also used for Social Security payments and other sorts of things for the government. So people think it gets used by the Federal Reserve to calculate inflation. But the CPI is the thing that everyone sees, and it's close relative to PPI, the producer price index, which we've seen go up more recently, the cost of commodities and stuff, whereas the consumer price index is the cost of things on the shelves and stores. So it was created to have a benchmark to adjust government salaries, but it started to get out of hand, especially in the 70s, and several of the administrations of the Federal Reserve, several chairmen went through changes to sort of cut the volatility out of it so that it didn't have such wide spikes. So the whole intention there was to smooth it out, and that's done. And now, at this point, we're pretty much masking inflation, but it still shows up. And those moves that we saw after World War One and Two in Vietnam of 100 or 70% or 200% after Vietnam, it might not be as strong this time around because the CPI has been adjusted so much and manipulated to mask inflation that we might only see a 50% or maybe not even a doubling of the CPI after the inflation kicks in this time around during this secular bear period, during this flat period of the market.
On page 118, you say that inflation is now permanently muted. Isn't that a bad thing? Because so many people depend upon this gauge for their income.
I'm not praising. That's not a real complimentary comment there. I don't think it's great. I think the government does a lot to try to control things. I don't think they're going to be able to, though. It's permeating through anyway. You've seen inflation out there. The businesses where I live up in Nyack, I talked to the people there, and lettuce doubled in 1 week because of some issue. The guy who runs the coffee shop can't increase his prices right away. So there's inflation. It's just not really showing up in the official government numbers. But now we're seeing it.
So even though they've revised and massaged to level it out, as you show in that great chart, even though they've done that, they're not going to be able to contain it. Is that what you're saying?
They won't be able to contain it. You can't contain inflation. I mean, with the dollar down so far, you can use any number of other metrics like gold or milk is something that we look at. You could use healthcare costs, things other than food and energy. You can look out there and you can sense inflation. You can look at the CRB index, Commodity Research Bureau index of different commodities. But the CPI, no matter what they've done to it, is going to rise. It's already begun to rise. It just may not be as steep as the previous three cycles that this forecast and this pattern is based on. It might not be as steep as those.
You know, I sense, Jeff, in the book that you're somewhat of an optimist. You look at the past and you see that we've survived throughout all this time. On page 8, you say, only after the economy settles down and Washington refocuses on domestic issues will the stock market soar to new heights. On page 26, you say, until housing recovers, there is no chance for a meaningful or sustainable bull market to emerge. And on page 28, until the consumer confidence index heads back up, we don't expect a sustainable recovery. On page 30, not until we see a sustained retreat in unemployment will the economy be on the path to real recovery and higher growth rates. What if the economy doesn't recover in our lifetimes? What if there is no sustained retreat in unemployment? What if the housing market never comes back in our lifetime?
We're in trouble. We're going to be in a protracted period of bad economic times. My forecast is based upon that not happening. I can't see the economy not recovering in our lifetime unless it's extremely short, but I'm figuring I got at least another 40-some-odd years in me, and I don't know of any economies in the modern era that have not recovered in a period of a couple of decades. Japan's pushing it right now, and their whole recent disaster is probably going to prolong that recovery even further, which is awful. So we could find ourselves in a Japan-like scenario. But having that to learn from that we're all aware of, I think will help us prevent that. But if the war continues, if things spiral further out of control in the Middle East and North Africa and we get sucked into that, that will extend our long-term sideways pattern. I would push out my dates of the boom beginning and rising up 500%. So there are factors that if these things don't fix themselves or get cured, then we run the risk of the superboom not occurring. My contention is that we will and are already on the path to that, but there are things that can happen. I don't see a natural disaster necessarily affecting the U.S., but I do think that the fallout from what's happened in Japan could affect the financial markets down the line, just like the 1906 San Francisco quake ended up being a major factor of the banker's panic of 1907, having drained New York of capital for rebuilding and also London, which was the and still is somewhat of an insurance capital of the world there. So with the European banking problem still dragging things down and Japan having this disaster to recover from could drain the international banking system at some point on the line within a year or so if it plays out that way, like we saw in 06, 07. Mm-hmm. 1907.
Right. Fascinating stuff in there on those panics. On page 22, your charts on home sales, I think they're really revealing, Jeff. Page 22, you have existing home sales, and you can see how it's climbing up until about 2006 or so, and a precipitous drop, a little climb back up, and a more precipitous drop. On page 24, housing starts. Talk about falling off a cliff and dying. Looking at them, it makes me feel that because the drop is so precipitous, new home sales chart on page 24, on page 25, the housing market index, because these drops are so precipitous, I don't see how, if I was a chart reader, let's say, and I like to look at charts and see what I can make out of them, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but here it's beyond dramatic. Am I off base with that?
Beyond dramatic might be a little melodramatic, but it is definitely dramatic, and that's the point here. And it's not until we see these recover that we'll be able to ignite the next boom. Again, the book has a bullish bias to it, but within it and within the forecast is a forecast for the market to have sustained difficulty and the economy to have a sustained difficulty over the next several years, as it has during previous bust cycles like this. So, yeah, this is not getting better yet, but 5, 6, 7, 8 years down the line, a couple of presidential administrations down the line, and as we have in the past, I think we'll begin to have a sustained recovery out of this housing bear market and the other issues that continue to hold back the economy. And I think that once we see that sustained recovery, we'll have a real big blast off. We're not going to have 8.5% average return every year. It's going to be some years of lesser and some years like we had in the late 90s of double-digit returns that are going to create that 8.5% average. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be some big years once the boom gets underway.
Right, which, of course, you believe is going to happen. And that, of course, is why Yale's prediction in the 70s was so substantial, because when everyone was panicking, he saw through that and he said, no, now is the time to buy. When people want to sell, you should buy. People are buying, you should want to sell, right? It's kind
Isn't it buy low, sell high? Right. So my point here is, in all seriousness, especially right now, I mean, we have our seasonal sell signal right now. You don't have to sell, but please think before you go buying heavily into this big rally right now. If you're going to chase a little bit tail end of the momentum, that's fine. But if you're going to make a long-term purchase on the long side of the stock market, perhaps May, after a doubling over 2 years of the market, is not the best time to dump a whole lot of money into the stock market for the long haul. Maybe you want to wait until July or August, when we usually have a summer dip and the market's somewhere around 10,000 or lower.
Okay. And of course, the website again is StockTradersAlmanac.com. Where's the best place for listeners to pick that up? I know I saw it on StockTradersAlmanac.
Wherever books are sold. I created a little Tiny Earl, tinyearl.com/superboom, which will get you to the Wiley buy page, which will get you to any place you want to buy it online, and also to more information on it from Wiley. There's a new chart. I did a chart where I mapped out the next 15 years using my historical analysis of previous markets and seasonality and cyclicality. That's also on the blog. And some of the press information. There's a blog link off of StockTradersAlmanac.com. In there, I guess, earlier in this month, next 15 years was the blog post where you can see this chart that which basically plots out what the Dow is likely to do based upon this forecast.
Jeffrey A. Hirsch, the editor-in-chief of the Stock Traders Almanac and the author of Superboom, Why the Dow Will Hit 38,820 and How You Can Profit From It. I want to thank you so much for taking the time out to explain all this to our listeners. I thoroughly enjoyed the book and looking forward to the next one. Thanks for joining us today, Jeff.
Oh, my pleasure, Dave. Thanks for having me.